Study period number 34, Sabbath morning, 10 o'clock at the Arkansas Camp 1982, the last Sabbath of our fellowship together. Let's turn back now to a continuation of the study of Revelation. And this morning our attention returns to the 10th chapter. And the two verses I want to cover in the next two study periods, which will end, of course, our consideration of Revelation 4 this particular week, leaving chapters 11 to 22 for later consideration. Revelation 10 and verse 6. Perhaps we should read verse 5 to bring in the connection. And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven and swear by him that liveth for ever and ever, who created heaven and the things which therein are, and the earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he hath declared to his servants the prophets. First of all, we understand what the mystery of God is. From Colossians 1 verse 27, it is Christ in you, the hope of glory. We understand that. We spend time in previous camp meetings looking at the seed principle, now in printed form under the title of the living and the dead. We need to understand perhaps a little bit more fully is the statement that the mystery of God should be finished. Already during the week we have recognized the fact that the Laodicean message takes time to do its work, in fact years of time altogether, and the reason why it did not accomplish the work God designed it should cover or should achieve back in earlier days was because folk were not prepared to settle down to a long and thorough work of deep preparation. I'm very, very impressed, much more impressed during this camp meeting with this thought of a very extensive and thorough preparation I ever have been before. And I'd like to note some statements from the book of the writings in this particular connection to help us to appreciate this fact. On page 69 of the book Early Writings, there is a chapter entitled Preparation for the End. At Oswego, New York, September 7, 1850, the Lord showed me that a great work must be done for his people before they could stand in the battle of the day of the Lord. Let's meditate upon those words for a moment. The Lord revealed, or the Lord showed us, through Sister White of course, that a great work must be done for his people before they could stand. Now what does the word could indicate? Possibility, doesn't it? Possibility. In other words, unless this great work is done, this great work of preparation, then how much possibility is there for God's folk to stand in that final battle? No possibility whatsoever. Now, strangely, the Church of God has again and again made the mistake in the past of looking to a much shorter work being done than is actually necessary to prepare us for the battle of the great day of Almighty God Almighty. And let me stress again, of course, as the seven angels' presentation points out from Revelation 14 and 18, that we are not in this world simply to receive our own personal salvation. That's just the beginning of the story. We're in this world as God's ambassadors, as God's soldiery, as God's army, through whom the most tremendous demonstration of God's character shall ever be given, apart from that given by Jesus Christ himself. We're in this world to be the instruments which God will open the minds of the most wicked person upon the earth to the truth as it is in Jesus, so that those folk must decide for or against that truth forever, in a total and final stand upon the part of all concerned. And the battle before us and the task to be achieved will require extraordinary people to achieve it. Which reminds me again of the verse in Zechariah the third chapter where it talks about the people of God being men wondered at. Let's go back to Jesus Christ himself for a moment. And would we say that so far as qualification, quality, achievement and ability was concerned, he was an extraordinary person? Was he? Absolutely. as it mentioned during the week, at the age of 12, he was so extraordinary that he could outmatch the best minds in the nation of Israel, the best educated men, the best theologians, men with graying hairs, men who spent their whole lifetime studying the Word of God and preaching that Word to people. At the age of 12, Christ could outmatch them. Now, we must remember, of course, that Jesus Christ possessed no qualities and revealed no powers we may not have through him. And to give you full confirmation of that, I'd like to turn to the Desire of Ages. We're on page 668, I think it is, or 664. That point is very, very clearly made. It's page 668, I believe. So first of all, the statement says, as Christ lived the Lord humanity, so we may do if we will take hold of the strong for strength. We are not to place the responsibility of our duty upon others and wait for them to tell us what to do. We cannot depend for counsel upon humanity. The Lord will teach us our duty just as willingly as he will teach somebody else. If we come to him in faith, he will speak his mysteries to us personally. Our hearts will often burn within us as one draws nigh to commune with us, as he did with Enoch. Those who decide to do nothing in any line that will displease God will know, after presenting their case before him, just what course to pursue. And they'll receive not only wisdom but strength, power for obedience, for service will be imparted to them as God has promised. Whatever was given to Christ, the all things to supply the need of men, was given to him as the head and representative of humanity. And whatsoever we ask, we receive of him, because we keep his commandments and do those things that are pleasing in his sight. Now, I think the statement I'm thinking of, I actually have pinned in now here it is on page 664, sure enough. It's down toward the end of the paragraph. I'll read the paragraph, which is quite a short one. And the statement reads as follows: Verily, verily I say unto you, Christ continued, he that believeth on me, the works that I do shall he do also. The Savior was deeply anxious for his disciples to understand for what purpose his divinity was united to humanity. He came to the world to display the glory of God, that man might be uplifted by his restoring power. God was manifested in him, that he might be manifested in them. And that now comes the actual point I want to make, particularly in the last part of this paragraph. Jesus revealed no qualities and exercised no powers that men may not have through faith in him. His perfect humanity is that which all his followers may possess if they will be in subjection to God as he was. There is, of course, at the end of that paragraph, a condition laid down, and that is, if we will be in subjection to God as he was, then his perfect humanity is that which all his followers may possess. And Christ revealed no qualities and exercised no powers that men may not have through faith in him. In other words, if our children were to be raised up as Jesus was, if they were educated as Jesus was raised up, then at the age of 12, what would they be? Equal to what he was, because he possessed no qualities and exercised no powers that we may not have through faith in him. The presentation of the seven angels' message demonstrates that the same revelation of God's character as was given by Jesus Christ during his earthly sojourn and upon the cross of Calvary through his sinful humanity will again be given through the same fallen sinful humanity, but this time in the person of 144,000. Now Christ will give that revelation, but in order to give it, the people of God must have come to a very wonderful level of excellence and quality. No wonder the Laodicean message takes time to do its work. Jesus Christ, of course, spent 30 years in that preparation, and even when he came to his baptism and God personally accepted the consecration which he made, at the same time, Christ still felt that he needed still further communion with God to gain more strength, more efficiency, more power to go out and successfully meet the powers of darkness. Now I want today to dwell upon this thought of preparation a little bit, because the finishing of the mystery of God is a twofold work. First of all, it must be finished within the people through whom this demonstration is to be given. And secondly, it is to be finished so far as the revelation of mankind is concerned throughout the length and breadth of the entire world. First of all, there is the receiving of it by the people of God, and then there's the revealing of it by the people of God. Let's go back now to the Old Testament sanctuary for a moment. Leviticus, the 4th chapter. And let us notice the progressive works of atonement which are necessary to bring about the ultimate and complete work of God's grace in the soul. And this is very important, because in the great and mighty work of the second angel's movement, we find that the people of God had a wrong expectation. They expected Jesus Christ to come before they were actually ready for him to come. I'm about to read two statements now, one from the book of the writings, page 239, and the other one from Great Controversy. I think page 426, we'll look in just a moment. Now, this statement describes the tremendous level of spiritual experience to which the Advent Fathers came prior to the great disappointment. 50,000 people were in a condition which is described, at least for some of them, in these words. A spirit of solemn and earnest prayer was everywhere felt by the saints. A spirit of solemn and earnest prayer. And when those folk got together for prayer meetings back there, their prayer meetings last for 10 or 15 minutes. Did a small proportion of the group praying? No. Every person prayed. And the prayer meetings went on for hours as they entered into the very presence of God and felt that almighty sustaining presence possessing every one of them. And Sister White says, I just forgot what the statement is now, that as we moved down into Jacob's trouble, and even before that during the period of the loud cry, she there says, a spirit of prayer possessed the people of God. It came upon the people of God. In other words, within them was the very spirit of prayer. So when they prayed, they were literally expressing the inspiration and sense of need within themselves. And that's how it was back in the 44 movements. A holy solemnity was resting upon them. Angels were watching with the deepest interest the effect of the message, and were elevating those who received it, and drawing them from earthly things to obtain large supplies from salvation's fountain. God's people were then accepted of him. Jesus looked upon them with pleasure, for his image was reflected in them. They had made a full sacrifice, an entire consecration, and expected to be changed to immortality. But they were destined again to be sadly disappointed. The time to which they looked expecting deliverance passed, and they are still upon the earth, and the effects of the curse never seemed more visible. They had placed their affections on heaven, and in sweet anticipation had tasted immortal deliverance, but their hopes were not realized. Now, was it God's fault that they had been disappointed? No. The fault lay in a lack of education. The fault lay in them not being able to appreciate the extent of the work required to fit them for translation. Let's turn now to the book Great Controversy. We shall find the same facts demonstrated in slightly different words. I'm turning now to page 426 in this volume to find this information. Page 426 in the book Great Controversy. It's page 424. Perhaps I should go back and read page 423 first of all. And this page reads as follows. The subject of the sanctuary was the key which unlocked the mystery of a disappointment in 1844. It opened to view a complete system of truth, connected and harmonious, showing that God's hand had directed the great Advent movement and revealing present duty as it brought to light the position and work of the people. As the disciples of Jesus, after the terrible night of their anguish and disappointment, were glad when they saw the Lord, so did those now rejoice who had looked in faith for his second coming. They had expected him to appear in glory to give reward to his saints, to his servants. As their hopes were disappointed, They had lost sight of Jesus, and with Mary at the sepulchre had cried, "They have taken away my Lord, and I know not where they have laid him." Now in the Holy of Holies they again beheld him, their compassionate high priest, soon to appear as their king and deliverer. Light from the sanctuary illumined the past, the present, and the future. They knew that God had led them by his unerring providence. Though like the first disciples, they themselves had failed to understand the message which they bore, yet it had been in every respect correct. In proclaiming it, they had fulfilled the purpose of God, and their labor had not been in vain in the Lord. Begotten again into a lively hope, they rejoiced with joy unspeakable and full of glory. Note this sentence, which I'll come back to in a moment. Light from the sanctuary illumined the past, the present, and the future. It demonstrated to them why they had been disappointed. It showed them that there was still a very great work of preparation yet to be accomplished, as revealed in the sanctuary. And we shall go back in a moment to the sanctuary service to explore these great evidences ourselves, and gave them fresh confidence to go forward in that work of preparation. Now turn to page 424, and passing over one or two paragraphs, I come down to this one, which reads, Christ had come not to the earth as they expected, but as foreshadowed in the type, to the most holy place of the temple of God in heaven. He is represented by the prophet Daniel as coming at this time to the Ancient of Days. Now quote from Daniel chapter 7 verse 13, I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came not to the earth but to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. This coming is foretold also by the prophet Malachi. The Lord whom you seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant, whom you delight in, behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. Malachi 3 verse 1. The coming of the Lord to his temple was sudden, unexpected to his people. They were not looking for him there. They expected him to come to the earth in flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God and that obey not the gospel. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 8. But the people of God, were not yet ready to meet their Lord. There was still a work of preparation to be accomplished for them, and we might also say in them. Now we tend, of course, they tended back there to think in terms of the work of preparation being needed out there in the world. As they looked upon themselves, they expected translation, they thought they were ready for translation, but when they came up to October 22, 1844, then the light was brought to them that they needed a still greater work of preparation to be accomplished for them. Light was to be given, directing their minds to the temple of God in heaven, and as they should by faith follow their high priest, his ministration there, new duties would be revealed. Another message of warning and instruction was to be given to the church. Not just by it, but to the church. Now if you turn with me to Malachi 3 verses 2 and 3, we'll come back to Leviticus 4 in just a moment. Malachi 3 verse 2 and 3, we have before us a very clear description of what this additional work of preparation involved. Already we have read the first verse, which tells that the Lord would come to his temple. Now comes verse 2 and 3, but who may abide the day of his coming? And who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. And he shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. And when this work shall have been done, verse 4 says, then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be present unto the Lord, as in the days of old and as in former years. In comment upon this, I now read from page 425 in the book Great Controversy. Those who are living upon the earth when the intercession of Christ shall cease in the sanctuary above are to stand in the sight of a holy God without a mediator. And what does that mean? It means this. Their robes must be spotless. Their characters must be purified from sin by the blood of sprinkling. Through the grace of God and their own diligent efforts, they must be conquerors in the battle with evil. While the investigative judgment is going forward in heaven, while the sins of penitent believers are being removed from the sanctuary, there is to be a special work of purification, of putting away of sin among God's people upon earth. This work is more clearly presented in the message of the Revelation 14. When this work shall have been accomplished, the followers of Christ will be ready for his appearing. Then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be present unto the Lord as in the days of old and as in former years, Malachi 3 verse 4. Then the church which our Lord and his coming is to receive to himself will be a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, Ephesians 5:27. Then she will look forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners. Song of Solomon 6 and verse 10. Now this brings to view the fact that from the most holy place of the heavenly sanctuary there is a very, very special work of purification and a putting away of sin to be accomplished by Jesus Christ on behalf of his people. Now some folks find this a little difficult to understand because the work in the most holy place is an atonement designed to cleanse the building itself from the presence of sin and not the people down here upon this earth. Let's come back to that in just a moment when we look at the sanctuary service to see how Jesus Christ today performs a a double work in the sanctuary up in heaven. Let's turn back to the fourth chapter of Leviticus. Excuse me. Now this chapter talks about the making of the atonement in the first department of the heavenly sanctuary. And the word atonement, it means cleansing, it means justification, it means restoration, or literally to bring a person back into at-one-ment with the God of heaven again. Now prior to the atonement which is made in the actual holy place, there is a sacrifice made out in the courtyard. And in the Spirit of Prophecy, we're plainly told of this sacrifice was also an atonement. In fact, it was the atonement. I'll turn to one or two statements now from various sources in the Spirit of Prophecy, starting with the Review and Herald, September 24, 1901, which says, Christ planted the cross between heaven and earth, and when the Father beheld the sacrifice of his Son, he bowed before it in recognition of its perfection. It is enough, he said. The atonement is complete. The atonement is complete. Let's now draw a diagram of the earthly sanctuary so we can follow through these various atonements and the particular work which each one was designed to accomplish, bearing in mind that all this was a shadow of better things to come. There's the two-apartment sanctuary. In the first apartment, which there was a table of showbread, the altar of incense and the seven-branched golden candlestick standing over against the wall. In the inner apartment there was the Ark of the Testament, where the presence of God rested between the cherubim which overshadowed the mercy seat. There was the glory of God in that beautiful building. And outside in the courtyard there was, of course, the altar of sacrifice and the laver for washing, and then there was the courtyard which surrounded the entire structure, and the people came in through the front gateway here to bring their sacrifices to the cross. Now the courtyard is a symbol of this earth, and every single event which took place in the courtyard in the type took place upon this earth in the antitype. Right, every event, let me say it again, which took place within the courtyard in the full view of the people in the type took place where? In the antitype, on this earth. Right, so the lamb was slain always right there by the altar of sacrifice, and that is a symbol, of course, of Jesus' death upon the cross of Calvary when he died for our sins. Now when Jesus died at the altar of sacrifice in the antitype, which was upon the cross in actual fact, the Father up in heaven said, as he viewed the perfection of that atonement, God the Father said, it is enough. The atonement is complete. The atonement is complete. Now, this has led many people, including modern Adventists for that matter, and certainly, of course, the same principle as revealed in the Scriptures, has led Protestant churches to think in terms of there being only one atonement, only one work for God's people, and that was accomplished where? Upon the cross of Calvary. Now, very obviously, if a person stops at that point of time and does not go beyond the cross, does not experience the atonement in the holy place, or in the most holy place, or upon the scapegoat, because at least three more atonements, then that person's preparation to stand in the battle of the day of God, and that person's preparation for that, as a matter of fact, to even stand in the heavenly courts at last, will be totally and completely inadequate. Now, let's think about this for a moment. If we viewed the cross as being the first and last and only atonement, then very obviously, of course, there is no application of blood to the person. It is because Jesus Christ ministers in the sanctuary and is able to save to the uttermost those that come unto God by Him. You read that beautiful text in Hebrews 7:25, which says, "Wherefore He is able also to save them to the uttermost that come unto God by Him." And what's the rest of the verse say? "Seeing He ever liveth to make intercession for them." It doesn't say because He died upon Calvary's cross. It says because, or seeing, that He ever liveth to make intercession for them. Now, where does Christ live today? In the sanctuary. Where does He intercede for us today? In the sanctuary. And therefore, He's able to save us by virtue of these atonements, not just by the one made there upon the cross of Calvary. Now, those people, of course, who believe in the cross and the cross alone as being the way of life, you'll find that they also believe that we don't have to obey the law, that righteousness is not required of the Christian, that Christ did it all for us. They simply impute or credit that righteousness to our account, and on the basis of His virtue, of His merit, we enter into the judgment or enter into the heavenly courts. And the extreme position, of course, is that once a person has been saved, then what? Once saved, always saved. But now let's come back to Leviticus, the fourth chapter. And of course, there are many more statements I could have read in regard to the perfection and the atonement made by Jesus Christ upon the cross. But if you take your volume 7a of the Bible Commentary and turn to page 663 in the back section called Questions on Doctrine, you'll find there's quite a page or two of them compiled here for our convenience. And it's just a matter of reading them one after the other. As you read them one after the other, you will get the point there quite clearly. Let's now look at Leviticus, the fourth chapter, where we find it very, very plainly stated that an atonement was made for the people in the first apartment of the heavenly sanctuary, earthly sanctuary rather, which was the type. Now this service concerned sins of ignorance, the unknown sin which the person had not come to realize or to see up until this point of time. And this service must not be confused with the Passover. The Passover service was a service which in type taught the people how to escape from the bondage of sin. Because the Passover is a picture of physical deliverance from physical bondage. And just as the man in Egypt, the Israelite in Egypt, was serving the power of the Egyptians, so the man of Romans 7 served the power of sin. And once the people of Israel had left Egypt, now what have they left behind? In type, the land of sin and the land of bondage. But having left behind the land of sin and bondage by the way of the cross, and you remember, of course, that every Israelite who left the land of bondage went out through a doorway where blood had been sprinkled upon the, let this be the doorstep. Now, blood had been sprinkled on the top and the two side posts of that doorway. Blood was sprinkled there, blood was sprinkled there, and blood was sprinkled there. And inevitably, of course, blood would fall upon the step as well, because when you're splashing blood up there, what happens to many, many drops of it? It'll fall on the step below. Now, if you connect those points together, what have you got? You've got the cross, and every Israelite who left the land of Egypt that night, they left that land by the way of the cross, as they walked through that blood-spattered door and left behind the land of bondage forever. Now, it was a free people then who came to the sanctuary day by day to offer their sacrifices and to receive remission of their hitherto unknown sins. He was no longer delivered from bondage, but he was forgiveness for sin that they came for in the daily service. Which indicates, of course, that being saved by the cross from the land of bondage is but the beginning of the several atonements which stand between us and final perfection and final preparation for the kingdom. Now we know this service quite well in Leviticus the 4th chapter. We just run by quickly there to make the point clear to all who may not have heard this before. We start first of all with the sinner's problem, and that is, even though he's a born-again child of God, has dedicated himself to God's service, has experienced deliverance from the land of Egypt, he still has unknown sins, wrong ideas and theories, habits and practices embedded in himself still. Now, to help us to appreciate this, I'd like to share with you now a clearer realization which I gained the other day in regard to the seed principle, in which, of course, we make the distinction between the seed of Christ and the seeds of truth on one side, and the seeds of Satan and the seeds of error on the other side. Right? So let's put these two points down then. The unregenerate, unconverted man out there in the world, he has the seed of Satan. And what then does that make Satan to be to him? His father. Right? As Christ said to the Pharisees, you are of your father the devil, the lust of your father you will do. Now on the other side, this man is also filled with the seeds of error. Right? But as the Spirit of God begins to work upon his heart, now before I say any more about that part, now what is Satan in regard to these seeds of error? What is he now? He is the... No, he's not the father. He's the author, isn't he? Right? He's the author of the seeds of error. Now the scriptures say in John the first chapter that Jesus Christ is the light which lights every man that cometh into the world. Isn't that true? So in due time the Spirit of God begins to work upon this man's mind and begins to sow seeds of truth among those seeds of error. In fact, the seeds of truth, as far as they are received, will displace and dispel the seeds of error. So we move on then to this man, and here we find in his second state, he is now the same as he was here so far as this side is concerned, but now on this side we find that this man still retains certain seeds of error, but he now has mixed with those seeds of error, seeds of truth. And now, in him there are two authors. Satan, of course, is the author of the seeds of error, but who is the author of the seeds of truth in that person? Right, Christ is the author of those seeds of truth in that particular person. Now this man, as these seeds of truth become more active in his experience, he passes into what experience? Romans 7, right? That's the situation of the man of Romans 7. He still has the seed of Satan, but in his mind, seeds of truth have begun to work, and they have produced in him a longing, so far as his mind is concerned, to walk in all the ways of God in truth and righteousness. Now, the time comes when this man is delivered from the seeds of Satan. That is, Satan is no longer his father. So now we have this man where he's in the position that Christ has become his new father. He's now a born-again Christian. He's escaped from the land of Egypt. So he has Christ's seed, and of that seed, of course, Jesus Christ is the Father. But now what about the seeds of truth and the seeds of error? Is he now completely delivered from the seeds of error? No, he's not. So he's the same as the man of Romans 7, excepting the proportion is looking more favorable. In other words, there's more and more seeds of truth and less seeds of error. Now this process of getting rid of the seeds of error throughout the marriage experience with Jesus Christ, that process is called reformation, or is called the work of sanctification. And it represents the growth which takes place after the original work has been accomplished. Now the transition from being a child of Satan to being a child of Christ, leaving the land of bondage to the land of freedom, is illustrated by the Passover service. But the process of delivering a person from wrong ideas and theories, habits and practices is illustrated by the daily service. So this work in the first department then carries forward the work begun by the deliverance from the land of Egypt in type. You see the distinctions? Right, we're moving along now up the ladder of progress toward the eternal perfection in Jesus Christ. Now what Satan does is this. Before we are born again Christians, then we are slaves to Satan's power. But once we have become born again Christians, we do not pass from bondage to bondage. The great mistake, of course, which many people make, and you probably find that your critics, and I promise you, you'll have some as you go back to your own areas and try and spread this message, that your critics will say to you, aha, so you've lost the carnal mind, you're no longer in bondage to Satan, so you folk are perfect, you can't do anything wrong. You're now a slave to righteousness. But is there any such thing as slavery to righteousness?
No.
Never. Christ is not a slave master. And therefore, we are not in bondage to him. But here we have seeds of error in our minds after we have become born again Christians. So Satan comes and works through these erroneous ideas that we have to stir up our human nature, to develop in our human nature an evil spirit. Impatience, anger, even hatred can be generated there. Now Satan is no longer in control of us, and he can't make us do these things, but he can certainly stimulate us to do those things. And so the wrong spirit then is developed in a person after he has been born again, and God designs, of course, that we shall recognize in the presence of this wrong spirit that we must have some ideas in our mind which are wrong, and our task, of course, is to be forgiven and cleansed of that wrong spirit so that human nature is brought back under the control of a sanctified will. Now, translating this to the sanctuary service, it comes together like this. In Mount of Blessing, page 76, Sister White there says, the season of temptation, under which it may be one falls into grievous sin, does not create the evil that is revealed, but only develops and makes manifest that which was hidden and latent in the heart. Now, when I was in Africa, quite a number of years ago, on this particular trip, I mean, I was there just a few weeks ago, of course, again, but I found that the African people were very, very well able to grasp this principle, because I taught it to them in the context of their own experience. Now, if there's one thing an African fears, it's lions. I was amazed at how terrified the average African is of a lion. I can tell you some very human stories about that, but my time is almost gone, so I won't tell it to you. But I would tell the story of them like this. Now here was a little African village with thatched roofs, little round huts with thatched roofs. The walls are made of clay and the roofs of grass, and they have a thorn bush fence all the way around the huts. And at night time they keep their cattle and themselves inside that thorny wall to keep the lions out. Mind you, today most lions, of course, are locked away in reservations, and you don't have lions running free excepting in the northern and more in the central African countries like Zaire, which was the Belgian Congo. Now I said, day by day, the farmers in this village took their oxen along a path that led them, unknown to them, right by a cave in which a lion had taken up residence. They didn't know he was there. Now this lion had gorged himself the night before, this particular day of which we're telling the story, and so he was glad to sleep in the warmth of that cave all day long. And so he didn't care about the cattle going past his den, nor about the voice of the herdsman and so forth, as he slept on. But late in the afternoon, a young man who kind of felt that there was something in that cave, he heard snoring going on there, took a long bamboo pole and began to prod in the cave. And naturally what happens, he wakes up the sleeping lion, who promptly bounds out and eats the foolish young man. Now I say to them, did that bamboo rod create the lion or disturb the lion? And the answer is so self-evident, isn't it? Now I said, what would you all do? Well, they said we'd engage the services of a mighty hunter who would come along and kill that lion so he was no longer in that cave and therefore no longer a threat to us. Now I said to the Africans out there, supposing now we put a lamb in that cave, and you took the same bamboo rod and poked the lamb, would he come out and eat you like the lion did? And again, the answer is self-evident, isn't it? Now, in like manner, it is God's way to root out this evil so temptation no longer finds an answering cause from within, and put into the place of that evil a new nature altogether, So that as the Zohar of Ages 391 says, love takes the place of hatred. It takes the place of hatred. And when love is the motive of action in life, then very obviously, of course, our reactions must be different from what they are and were if hatred is the dominating power in our experience. And so there is a work to be done in the daily atonement which is not achieved in the escape from Egypt. And we'll talk more about that as we come together for our next study period. Right now my time is gone, and being bound to this tape because I have to stop at this point of time.